WFM, the station that made the rock classics classic. Good morning, everybody listening at home and listening here at the Museum of TV and Radio. What a day it has been so far. What a day it is going to continue to be. Boy, was Dave Herman hot this morning or what? George Harrison, Southside Johnny, a couple of the Doors, Mayor Giuliani, Billy Joel. We're going to try and keep the momentum going because if I've been informed correctly, we have an old friend on the phone that I'd like you all to say good morning to. From the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, ladies and gentlemen, say good morning to Roger McGuinn. Roger.
Hi, Pete.
What part of the world are you in today, Roger?
I'm in Orlando, Florida today.
Which is home base for you.
That's right.
Are you out on the road? Are you busy this time of year? What are your current performing responsibilities?
I just kind of finished up touring. We were out on the road pretty much from April until, about a month ago. And the next thing I'm going to do is something for you guys.
Well, we're going to talk about that in a minute. I just want to let everybody know that this year was pretty much spent in celebration of and in promotion of a live album that you did called Live from Mars.
That's right.
You want to tell us a little bit about that one and how it came about and what it meant to you?
Well, it came out of my autobiography. I've been working on that, as you know, for quite a while, and it's still a work in progress. But at one point, I decided to see what the soundtrack of that autobiography would be. And so I put some songs together and took little pieces of the autobiographical text and put them as story anecdotes between the songs. And I started doing that live on stage. And we recorded it at a number of venues across the country. And gradually, I had enough tapes that I cut them all together on a digital editor and submitted it to a couple of record companies, and Hollywood Records liked it and put it out.
It is a wonderful one-man show, Roger, and it does touch upon parts of your career that people who only know you from the Byrds and as a solo act wouldn't recall. Could you tell us about a couple of those?
Yeah, they wouldn't know, perhaps, that I worked with Judy Collins on her third album, and that was where I got the idea to do songs like Bells of Remini and Turn, Turn, Turn. Or that I worked with Bobby Darin, and he told me about getting into rock and roll, and I started mixing the two forms of folk music and rock together back in around 1962, 1963, and gradually I went out to L.A. and got together with Gene Clark and David Crosby, and we formed the Byrds around that sound.
One of my favorite stories from that era, Roger, is how you and some or all of the guys in the group went to see a particular movie back in 1964, and it had a pretty big influence on you. What was that all about?
Well, we were all big fans of the Beatles, and when the movie A Hard Day's Night came out, we all went as a group. The Byrds were already together, and we went not once, but two or three times to see the movie, and we took notes on what instruments the Beatles were playing. We said, oh, they got Ludwig drums. We better get some of those. Oh, look, George has a Gretsch guitar. We better get one of those. And what's that funny guitar with a... It sounds like a 12-string, but it doesn't look like one. Oh, it is a 12-string. A Rickenbacker 12-string. We got to get one of those. So we did. And we got all their instruments.
Had you played a 12-string before that time?
Oh, yeah. I've been playing acoustic 12-string since the late 50s when I got into it. I was influenced by Lead Belly and Pete Seeger and Bob Gibson, so I was already a 12-string player. In fact, everybody in the Byrds were playing 12-strings. Crosby had a 12-string, and Gene Clark had a 12-string. So we were all into 12-strings, but we weren't into electric 12-strings, so the Rickenbacker electric 12 made a big difference.
It has such a unique, full sound to it and became so characterized as part of the Byrds sound. Weren't you honored a couple of years ago by Rickenbacker, by the way?
Rickenbacker came out with a limited edition guitar that had my name on it, and I was just really honored. Yeah, it was a great thing they did. And they made 1,000 of these and sold them out within the year. And they're still out there as a collector's item. I guess individual collectors have them for sale, but they're not for sale from Rickenbacker anymore.
Fabulous and a big thrill for you, I am sure. Roger, I want to ask you a question specifically about this radio station because I do believe it played a role in your career at a number of points. Wasn't WNEW-FM right there at the beginning of the period when the Byrds were going from being primarily a singles-oriented band to an album-oriented band?
Absolutely. WNEW was right there. It was one of the great FM stations that was starting, you know, with freeform, and they could play anything, and it was definitely a help in getting the bird sound out there.
Yeah, because after the hits...
30th anniversary, Pete.
Thank you very much. Yeah, it seems, you know, they do say, like Jackson Browne in that song of his, the blink of an eye, you know, but it is 30 years of history that we are celebrating today. And you are one of those artists whose music has been a part of this radio station each and one of our 30 years. And we thank you for that, Roger.
Well, thank you for being there. All right.
Mentioned earlier that you will be joining us for a special event. Let's talk about that for just a minute. As you know, once the anniversary celebration is over, it's not time to sit back and rest. It's time to get to work on Hungerthon 97, an event which started here at WNEW-FM in 1975 with our late friend Harry Chapin. The tradition has continued ever since and will once again this year. And one of the events surrounding Hungerthon this year will be a mixed bag Hungerthon 97 concert at Town Hall on Monday, November 10th, starring Roger McGuinn.
Wow, that's great. Who else is on the bill, Pete?
Well, Jonathan Edwards will be there, and a couple of guests who, for reasons that I can't talk about right now, will be named later. It's like a couple of players to be named later.
That's great.
Roger,
I'm really looking forward to it, Pete.
You've played at Town Hall before. This won't be a first for you, will it?
I believe I have. I couldn't tell you the exact dates, but it's a place that I love. I love Town Hall.
The reason I mention it is because you mentioned earlier playing with Judy Collins when she did her live recording in 64. It must have been 63 or 64. It was done at Town Hall, and you were her guitar player.
Well, actually, I don't know if I was with her at that point. I recorded with her on her third album, which was a studio album. And I don't believe I was with her at Town Hall, but it's a wonderful venue, and I'm really looking forward to playing there.
Yeah, somewhere in the Elektra archives, there are a couple of live Judy tracks that have a guitar credit to you. But in any event...
You have a better memory than I do for my own work. That's really great, Pete.
We're going back to Town Hall with Roger McGuinn on Monday, November 10th for Hungerthon 97. Roger, thank you so much for taking time out of your day to remember our 30th anniversary. And we'll see you in about 10 days, my friend.
Okay. It's always great talking to you, Pete. Have a good 30th.
The place where classic rock lives, 1027 WNEW-FM.
WNEW-FM 30th anniversary live from the Museum of TV and Radio in Manhattan continues with Pete Fornatel here at the place where classic rock lives, 1027 WNEW-FM New York.
They can speak of hard-earned wisdom.
I agree with Dave. The billing is completely wrong. Any way you measure it, if you do it alphabetically, it should be Museum of Radio and Television. If you do it by age, it should be Museum of Radio and Television. Maybe only size places, then it would be television and radio. But for today, it's going to be the Museum of Radio and Television. There, that's done. That's official. You can come down and join us anytime between now and 7 o'clock this evening. There will be lots going on all day at 25 West 52nd Street for the 30th anniversary celebration of WNEW-FM. Did any of you hear any of that four-hour special last night that went back and took a look at the 30 years of WNEW-FM? You know, I knew that I was excited about this occasion, but did not expect to become as emotionally tangled up in it all as I did over the course of those 4 hours. There were moments there that were truly, truly breathtaking. Off the top of my head, Vin Scalzo's handling of one of the darkest nights in the radio station's history, the death of John Lennon, of course. And on the other end of the spectrum, the joy and triumph and jubilation at the bottom line in 1975 as WNEW-FM did a live broadcast of Bruce Springsteen and the Eastine Band, as Dave would have it in those days. That was one of the funnier moments. And on a personal level, I thought, not expecting Roger to call in that early when they asked what I would like to start off with today, I thought it only appropriate to play the first song that I ever played on the Midday Show when I took it over the first time around in April of 1971. It's a song called Beginnings by Chicago, and these many years later, you know, it still has relevance, because even though we've now wrapped up our first 30 years into a nice, neat package, this is the first day of our 31st year that's going to take us into the next century at the place where classic rock lives, 1027 WNEW-FM.
Celebrating 30 years as New York's classic rock station. And the home of New York's classic jocks.
I'm Carol Miller.
This is the place where classic rock lives. 1027 WNEW-FM, New York.
One, two, three.
1027 WNEW-FM, where classic rock lives. And that classic rock, of course, includes the Young Rascals. The Young Rascals, the middle-aged Rascals, the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame Rascals. I like that one the best. This is Pete Fornatel. We are live at the Museum of TV and Radio, and we'll be back with something special after this.
Know how you...
Midday Show, by the way. We're expecting a visit from Max Weinberg, Mighty Max, an alumnus of the E Street Band, and of course, currently the band leader on the Conan O'Brien program. We should put together a WNEW-FM 30th anniversary trivia game, because this would be a good question that will separate the hardcore listeners from the also-rans, and that would be, who was the musician whose record was first played on the radio station back on that night of October 30th, 1967. If you know, don't say anything. What I will tell you is that that musician will be with us in the noon hour today, playing live on the radio 30 years to the day later. I'm not even going to tell you who. We'll let the ones who know enjoy this moment of superiority, and the rest of you can catch up with us a little bit later on. We're also expecting a visit from one of the founding fathers of WNEW-FM, and that is Jonathan Schwartz. Who'll be here in an hour or so. Late last year, when it became apparent to me that I was going to sign up for another hitch at WNEW-FM, the first one lasted for 20 years. I hope this one lasts as long. I got in touch with some old friends of mine who have always been good to us and always good to the radio station to do an interview. And for one reason or another, it never got aired on the radio until this morning. We're going to do a little bit of a visit that I had with our friends Crosby, Stills, and Nash. And we talk about David's illness, and it's pretty poignant, but it's also pretty funny. And the song that we keyed it to was one that sort of fit the reunion that took place here back in January of this year when Dave, Dennis, and I came back. And that's the one called Deja Vu, because in a way, this is what this has been for all of us. Deja Vu all over again at 1027 WNEW-FM. Time I change radio stations, whether I have to or not. This is no exception. This is like deja vu all over again to be with you guys, and I appreciate you're doing this for me. On to some quick other subjects. David, first of all, a quick update on your health.
It's amazingly good. I need to lose as much weight as Stephen has. I wish that
I thought you were doing
wish
that
I had. I'm on He's inspired me. He's lost a bunch of weight, and I want to do the same exact thing. But aside from that, my health is just excellent, and I feel wonderful. You know, I'm able to come out here and work again, and that's, you know, just made me happy as a clam.
When was the operation now? How long ago?
November 18th, 94.
Don't want to be overdramatic here, but you stared death in the face.
Very close.
What did it look like?
It didn't. It was
scary. It looked
scary.
Like a manager.
Cold yeah. shot.
Flotsam.
Yeah, no. I got within what they said was a few weeks of it, or 2 or 3 weeks of it. I waited for a long time. The last 40 days that I waited, I was in the hospital waiting. The last 40 days of it, I was about 20 days of that in the hospital because they could no longer keep me alive outside the hospital. So I was pretty close to not making it.
What were you guys like during this period that David was so ill?
We were auditioning people.
You didn't hear the story about me grabbing that doctor by the neck and screaming, "Will you let me up in the morning?"
Oh, man. Yeah, they were calling up Timmy Schmidt, you know.
You had to feel helpless to a point, yes?
Yeah, there's nothing you can do, you know. You just have to go with your instincts. And, you know, I saw David, you know, the morning that he went in for his operation. And you can only wish him the best, you know. But I got him, you know. As I was leaving the hospital, at, I think 5 o'clock in the morning or something, leaving the hospital, I looked around at David and I said, "Now listen, you. Don't you leave me with Stills."
Don't leave me alone with Steven.
Yeah. Steven, we'll give you the last word on this one.
My last word on this. I promise my diet isn't something that will make the tabloids. Let's see. I went and saw him, but basically they were before they were limiting the visitation, so we kind of heard it was best to stay away. We were kind of...
I wasn't really in real good shape. What they did, you know what the truth is? They both stayed friends to me, and they were both wonderful.
As soon as I heard he could talk and take abuse, I ran right back down.
Heaped it on.
Yeah, actually, his code name in the hospital was Chester Nimitz, so I went and scared up from some damn where a three-star admiral's tank. Chester Nimitz was a three-star admiral, and he put it over his bed.
Yeah. They were real good to me, and Graham's wife Susan made me dinner several times, I think, and Graham brought it down, and Susan brought it down, which was also extremely kind, you know, because hospital food is hospital food.
Very cool.
The best thing they could have done was they gave me my job back when I got out.
Very nice.
Real nice of them.
Yeah, the auditions didn't go too well.
Now live at the Museum of Radio and Television on West 52nd Street, and I'll be back with a special guest in just a few minutes. Does the name Mighty Max mean anything to you? Stay with us. Thank you, Tony. Thank you, everyone listening at home today or in the office or in your cars, and certainly thank you to all of you who came down here to the Museum of Radio and Television to join us. Would you kindly join me in welcoming to the WNEW-FM microphones, Max Weinberg.
Thank you, everyone. Thank you, Pete.
Max, I have to say that you have had two of the greatest gigs on the planet, gigs that people would kill for, I am sure, that your days as a Mighty Max of the E Street Band being number one, and number two, the leader of the Max Weinberg 7 on the Conan O'Brien Show. Any Conan viewers here today? Any late-night TV watchers? Let's go in reverse order. How did that second job come about for you?
Well, that was very interesting because it was about 4 years after the breakup of the E Street Band in 1993. My wife and I were walking down 7th Avenue, just two blocks from here. And up on the corner, we saw Conan O'Brien. Now, my wife said, "Well, how do you know that's Conan O'Brien?" This was in May of 93, and nobody really knew at that time who Conan was. But I'd seen him a couple days before on an interview show after he'd gotten the late-night gig, and I recognized him. And I'd been looking for a couple of years for a way back into playing the drums. I hadn't actually played much, except for a few benefits that you guys had organized through the years. And he's standing on the corner of 7th Avenue and 54th Street, right near the Carnegie Deli. And I went up to him, and we started to talk, and one thing led to another. And You know, he had some very definite ideas of what he wanted to hear in music, and we both agreed that whatever he did should be fun, and that's what I had always specialized in, was having fun behind the drums. And as I said, one thing led to another, and we went on the air September 13th, 1993, and now we're into our fifth season.
Into your critically acclaimed fifth season with growing audiences, but in the beginning, things were a little shaky. Conan would get lambasted daily by the critics, and your renewals, it seemed, weren't 13-week cycles, more like maybe tomorrow, come back, we'll see.
Well, it was like, you know, Friday... They'll let us back Monday.
Was that nerve-wracking for everybody? Did it...
Actually, it wasn't, because when you're in the middle of that, you know, doing a show every single day, you really don't have the time to notice that stuff. And, you know, Conan had and continues to have such a definite idea of what he wants to do on television that was his vision then. It continues to today. It's great and very sort of rewarding for all of us to see that he was correct in what he wanted to do. He's got a very definite style and a sense of humor that's unique on TV. And it was basically, this is what he did. And, you know, we're very fortunate to have the support of NBC.
When did it turn around? When did you start feeling that it was no longer this week-to-week thing, but a really solid hit?
Well, when we all stopped having to go out on the street and pull people in for the audience. No, actually, I think it was about 2.5 years ago, Tom Shales of Washington Post, I believe it is, wrote a very complimentary column on Conan, which was absolutely a 100% turnaround from what he had written a year before.
Wow.
And that was a real turning point for us, you know. But from our point of view, we'd basically done the same thing, you know. We'd just go out there every day and try to put on the best show we could. And he really gained his audience. I've been having the time of my life. It's wonderful playing with these great musicians that I've been able to, you know, keep together for the 4.5 years that we've been on the air.
You handpicked him. You handpicked the Max Weinberg Seven.
Oh, yeah, I absolutely did, you know. As well, of course, the La Bamba and Mark Pender from the Asbury Jukes, people right. I played with for a long time. My partner, really, in the arrangement and co-leading of the band, in a sense, is Jimmy Vivino, who's well-known to New York audiences, who's just a wonderful arranger and guitarist. The keyboard player is Scott Healy, who's great. He was a friend of Jimmy's. The bass player is Mike Merritt, who was also a friend of Jimmy's. And Jerry Vivino plays saxophone, who's Jimmy's brother.
Right.
So if you want Jimmy, you get Jerry. And it was a great, coming together, because it had to be done very quickly. And it was sort of like, it reminded me of putting a band together like when I was in the garage when I was 14 years old. Just, you know, this guy has a guitar, this guy has a keyboard or an organ, and let's start a band. And we had about 10 days to get it together, and we did.
Well, you surely have the band thing down, and you're following in this tradition of great late-night talk show bands covering many different types of music over the years. The legendary names like Doc Severinsen and, of course, Paul Schaefer's long association with...
You know, the amazing thing to me was that I was always a big fan of Doc Severinsen's Tonight Show band.
Mm-hmm.
By far, historically, the best band that's ever been on television. And I used to sit watching them when I was in high school and say, gee, that looks like a great gig, a lot of fun. And, you know, because at that point I was young, I didn't know what I was going to do in music. I knew I wanted to play the drums. And, you know, so jump ahead 25 years, and I see my name in the same sentence as Doc Severinsen.
Oh, that's nice.
Yeah, it was an amazing thing. And he's a delightful gentleman and a wonderful performer today, you know. And there haven't been that many bands on TV.
Who was the drummer? Was it Mickey O'Shaughnessy?
Ed Shaughnessy. It was 30 years he was the drummer.
Yeah, any influence on you in that respect?
Well, sure, he was a great show band drummer, and that's what it's about. It's about projecting a certain type of energy, and Ed always did that. You know, I had the great privilege of being asked to play with Bruce at the 95 Grammys out in L.A., and the show was very accommodating, our show was, and I went out there, and I needed a substitute for one show. So I said, gee, let's get Ed Shaughnessy. He's the guy who knows how to do it. So he came in,
oh,
and
cool.
It was great for him to be back at NBC, and, you know, that was fun. It was kind of a historical link-up.
Here's where I wanted to go with this, though. You've got the music thing covered. Nobody questions that. Did you know from the get-go that performance would be a large part of your role on the show? Did you adapt to it right away? Had there been anything in your background to explain the comedy that you do so well on the show?
Well, some of the mistakes I used to make on stage were pretty comical, but no, you know, it was just sort of a thing that developed because I felt comfortable with it. And, you know, it's a late night TV show, and the purpose is to have people have fun with it, you know? And there's so much in the world today that you can't have fun with that if we're able to let people laugh for an hour, I thought that was kind of a noble calling.
Absolutely.
So I have no problem being, asked to put on a dress, which I've done on many occasions. I'm following in the great tradition of Milton Berle and those people who have done that.
Your Mary Had a Little Lamb, by the way, is one of the finest that's ever been.
Classic TV moment. In fact, they're reeling in the tapes in this building as we speak.
Off the top of your head, by the way, this is Pete Fornatale with Max Weinberg on WNEW-FM at the Museum of Radio and Television. We'll be here all day celebrating our 30th anniversary, and thank Max for being a part of it. Off the top of your head, two or three of those fun moments from the Conan show that are just high on your list?
Well, the things that you remember are the things that weren't planned. There was one bit we did where we built a new stage set for the band, and it was a comedy bit called Is Max Too High? Which meant the drum riser, was it too big? You know, so throughout the bit, in successive moments, they had me on a 10-foot riser, and then it got higher and higher. And at one point, they had some dry ice blowing in, so it looked like I was on the top of a mountain. And I'm doing this bit, and I'm playing it very straight. I don't see any problem, you know. And meanwhile, I'm 20 feet above everyone else. And suddenly a bird on a wire comes across, you know, and a guy's over there like in a clothesline moving the bird. It's supposed, because I'm so high up, and the bird gets stuck. The bird stops flying, and everybody starts laughing, because when these sort of technical things happen, you know, with Conan, one of the things Conan and Andy are so brilliant at are turning these moments into very funny elements,
with it,
you know?
Yeah.
So that's what they started to do, you know, but I had to play it straight, which made it even more funny, because I'm sort of the straight guy, you know, generally over there. And that was one moment that really stands out, you know. Everything broke down.
Somewhere Ernie Kovacs is smiling.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Well, we're in that tradition of, you know, nothing is too outrageous.
Definitely, definitely. Now, after all of those years of non-activity with the E Street Band, you had a couple of phone calls a couple of years ago that reunited you. You mentioned the Grammy appearance with Bruce. There was also the recording sessions for the tracks that were added onto the Greatest Hits album. Was it like riding a bicycle? You just got back in there and picked up where you left off? Does that describe the experience or not?
Yeah, in a matter of speaking, actually it does, because, you know, we had played together for so many years and so intensely when we did play together. And it was quite remarkable, actually, that everyone went right back to where we had left off. It was about 8 years before, but everyone was much better at what they were doing. You know, which is actually something Bruce said to me when the band broke up, was that, you know, this is an opportunity for everyone's growth, which was absolutely true. Everyone did grow and came back more mature and, you know, better musicians. We got tremendous results very quickly. We always got results very quickly, but it was very, very easy. That was about 2 years ago.
Here's a tough question, maybe one that you can't answer, but I'll throw it at you anyway. Tomorrow, a phone call comes from Bruce. Says, listen, I've enjoyed what I've done the last couple of years, but I really want to put the E Street Band back on the road, do a world tour. Max, you're my drummer. What do you do?
You know, you're not going to believe this, but no one has ever asked me that question. Well, you know, as I said, what he told us 10 years ago was that the dissolution of the band would be a great opportunity, even though you might not see it that way right now. And as he was, you know, most of the times correct, he was absolutely correct. It was a great opportunity for all of us. I'm very happy doing what I'm doing. And the idea of doing that it's never been broached. It's never been brought up. As we do now, as we did in the old days, we always took it one step at a time. We found that it's better not to get ahead of yourself. You know, we had a ball doing that, the Blood Brothers project, which turned out to be a documentary and the album. So other than that, we've never really talked about doing anything. It's sort of a hypothetical that's kind of hard to address. You know, we're spread out all over the country. He just got off a very, very successful 2-year solo acoustic tour, and I don't think his plans include leaving his family again so soon. Mm-hmm. I can't speak for him, of course. I'm very happy doing what I'm doing now. So the future's always been very hard to predict.
Always has. Let me ask you one last question. We were talking earlier about a radio moment where you heard your own music on the air somewhere, and you thought of one with Bruce in Los Angeles. You want to tell us about that?
Well, actually, it was in Northern California, and it was really interesting because there were a couple of moments. I remember a moment in Dallas, Texas, all of us swimming at a Holiday Inn when Bruce's former manager ran out of the hotel and said Born to Run had just gone number one.
Whoa.
You know, and I remember that I was about 23 years old at the time, you know, and that blew all of our minds, you know, with number one album in the country. It was very, very exciting, you know, and you know, it was a very different thing back then getting played on the radio than it is now. It was equally as hard, I think, but there was something about, wow, you have a number one record then. The music business, the recording business, the radio business was so different back then. It made a big impression. The other thing was that I do vividly remember driving in a car with Bruce on one of those dark streets in Northern California, and we had the radio on, and it was late at night. It was after a concert. We had just come back from getting something to eat, and Jungle Land came on the radio. And that violin and piano intro stopped us and stopped the car. We pulled over to the side of the road and we sat there for the 9 minutes that the song takes, total silence and total darkness, listening to Jungle Land. That was the first time, certainly, that I'd heard it on the radio. And it was a phenomenal experience. I've never forgotten that experience. And I have to tell you, even now, if I'm in the car, you know, I'll be in there with my kids and the family and everything. One of our songs comes on the radio, I jam that thing out. You never lose that thrill.
Absolutely. Let's hear the sounds on the radio. Listen, I asked you to pick one for us from those days to play on the radio, and you were pretty adamant about the one you wanted to hear. Tell us.
Well, this is a song that you don't hear that often, you know, and it was always one of my favorites to play, and I think everyone in the E Street Band would concur with that. It was just one of those songs that at the end of the show, we always kind of blew it out with this. And I remember bringing a demo tape of this song home to this was a long time ago, late 70s, bringing a demo tape home of that song to my girlfriend at the time, who's now my wife, and saying, listen to this thing we just cut. This is it. This is exactly how I like to play the drums. And every time I played that song, I thought of that moment, and I thought of the fact that I'm getting to do exactly what I wanted to do when I was 12 years old, play drums on a song like that with a great band like this. And it's one of my favorites, and I hope people remember it, and I think you're going to play it now.
Fantastic. I first want to thank you. You are always a welcome guest at WNEW-FM. Continued success to you, Max.
And likewise to you, Pete. Congratulations to you and all your colleagues and all my friends at WNEW Radio.
Can't tell you how much we appreciate your being here today, and we're going to serenade you out with the song you were just talking about, which is Ramrod by Bruce Springsteen and the E Street Band at 102.7 WNEW-FM.
It's an all-day 30th anniversary party.
After all, I can remember when I was with you back in the mid and late 70s, and we celebrated at that time your 10th anniversary. And look how much you've accomplished since then. Well, Mark Chernoff asked me if I could recall some special moments during my 3.5 years on the station. And I can remember being on the air for the first concert from Giant Stadium. It was one that we carried live, the Steve Miller Band, I think it was. The night in the fall of 1977 when James Cagney and his wife happened to be listening while attending a party up in Kent, Connecticut, with his horse trainer, who was an avid WNEW-FM fan, getting a chance to talk to James Cagney and play him a song on the overnight. That was a thrill. I can recall the night we, you know, in those days, we used a mixer, a microphone, and two turntables, and gosh, if you lost a turntable, you were in trouble, and it happened one night. We made an adventure out of it, worked all night with only one turntable. But I must tell you, years later, because I left in 1978, here at Light FM, I still, to this day, get calls and letters from people who say, I remember listening to you when I was in college, or I remember listening to you on my FM converter in my car on WNEW-FM back in the 70s. And I'm proud to say I was, and I wish all of you folks at the radio station a wonderful 30th anniversary, and let's keep in touch.
1027 WNEW-FM, the station that made the rock classics classic, or sometimes we say classic rock and classic jocks. That was one of them. That was Al Bernstein, who was with us for a period in the late 70s and early 80s. And of course, the reason he can't be here today is that he does work down the dial at WLTW these days. But we are very glad that Al chose to be a part of our 30th anniversary party. Can also tell you, you among the computer literate out there, I myself am caught on a an off-ramp of the information highway. But for those of you who aren't, check out our 30th anniversary broadcast on ipsnews.com. We've noticed these video cameras walking around the auditorium here at the museum today, and that's what it's for. This is being preserved for broadcast, or computer cast. I'll get it down. I'll ask my kids. They'll straighten me out about it. But it's ipsnews.com. We had the opportunity to pick a lot of the music that you're hearing on the station today. Max Weinberg just picked a favorite of his. I'd like to go back to the year of our birth, 1967, for a song that, in a sense, epitomized the kind of music that you heard on WNEW-FM in the early days, and then spread out over into the mainstream as well, because this song became a number one single in 1967. And you know it was 67 by the name of the group. It was the Strawberry Alarm Clock. And I can vividly remember Alison Steele playing this song on the radio. And I felt, like everyone else, that it was just for me at 1027 WNEW-FM.
1027 WNEW-FM. Classic Rock, 1967.
Was like back in those early days of 1967. The Electric Prunes and the Strawberry Alarm Clock, thank you very much. In those days, the library was very small. You know, if you had the latest album by the Beatles, the Stones, the new one by the Doors, and a couple of things like the Prunes and the Alarm Clock, that was it. Boy, have things grown and grown and grown in the 30 years since. I've got a rare recording, by the way. I'll tell you the story about it. It involves a lost verse of one of Donovan's biggest hits, and I'll be playing that for you right after these messages.